for you in our InTune studio. So join me, Katie Derham, and Sean Rafferty for InTune, weekday evenings at 5 on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's midday. Next, Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the author Diana Melly.
Diana Melly has lived life on something of a roller coaster. She's experienced passion, great friendships, and celebrity, but also depression, illness, heartbreak, and the deaths of not one but two of her children. Running through her life for 46 years was her enduring but extremely complicated marriage to the jazz musician and bon vivant George Melly, who died in 2007. Diana has co-edited the letters of her friend Jean Rhys and has written two novels, a searingly honest memoir and a book about her late flowering love of ballroom dancing. And she's campaigned for charities, helping drug addicts and people living with dementia. Diana, we'll talk more about your extraordinarily eventful life. But first, I really want to discover a little bit about this passion for opera, which has come late to dominate the music you listen to. I mean, if you'd been selecting your favourite music perhaps 3 or 4 years ago, opera might not have featured at all. So what, who, how changed your musical taste so dramatically?
At the beginning of the pandemic, I got locked up very early because my lodger, who's called Lichvi, was teaching about the spread of viruses. And he said to me, this virus is going to get very serious and you must stop going to tea dances and you must actually stop going to parties. And he said, instead, I will rig up for you in your sitting room a projector and a screen and speakers and you can sit and listen to opera. And I thought, opera? Well, I'll give it a go. And I thought, well, I could watch films. I could do anything. Anyway, he set it all up and he played me one or two operas. And I thought, no, this is OK. I do like this. And so that's really how I started listening to opera. And now I listen to it all the time. I now don't always have to watch it. I often now just listen on these fabulous speakers I've got. And from then on, I was off. And he took me a couple of times to Covent Garden in standing seats. But he said, don't worry, I've booked standing seats where there's an empty row in front of us, so we'll be able to slip in. And we did. I couldn't stand for the whole of Wagner. And then he also took me to Glyndebourne as well. I was actually in a wheelchair at that moment because I'd had pneumonia, but the wheelchair got me there.
Well, we're going to hear music from operas by Verdi, Massenet and Gluck. But first Puccini and Renato Scotto singing the wonderful aria Un bel di vedremo from Madame Butterfly. But I think seeing this when you were very young actually almost put you off opera for life.
My first experience of opera was just awful. I was going out with the politician Tony Crossland and he invited me to Covent Garden with his friends, Lord Goodman, and I think Goodman's wife. And we were sitting in the royal box, and I was a bit nervous. And just before the curtain went up, he turned to me and he said, for God's sake, don't cough. And I think I just sat frozen. I can't remember what I saw, whether I liked it. All I can remember is that I was trying not to cough. So after I began to love opera, I thought, I don't want my children or grandchildren to go through anything like that. So I decided I would treat myself and them and get some good seats to see Madame Butterfly. So that's what I chose, to give them a really good experience of opera. And it worked. They all loved it, particularly my son and one of the grandchildren. When I was choosing this selection, I listened a great deal to different versions till I had chosen the right one. I don't think you can have a very strong voice for Madame Butterfly.
It has to have the vulnerability.
Exactly, yes.
Renato Scotto with that aria and Bel Diva Dremo from the second act of Puccini's Madame Butterfly. John Barbirolli conducting the orchestra of the Rome Opera House. You were married to George for 46 years. I think you met when you were only about 24?
Yes.
You were working as a nightclub hostess and a model, and already twice married with two children. And George was 35 and also married. What was it about him that you found exciting?
His reputation, I think. I was entranced by his reputation and incredibly nervous when
he... What, his bad reputation?
Yes. I heard he had a girlfriend who, if he was behaving badly, she would just pick him up and take him out from the party, slung over her shoulders. I mean, things like that were very exciting to hear
about. Well, he was a larger-than-life character, wasn't he?
He was, and remained so.
Yeah. And I think... What was so infectious about him was that curiosity and love of so many different things. It wasn't just the jazz, which he did in a very idiosyncratic manner, but, for example, his love and collection of paintings, rather wonderful things he picked up, didn't he?
Yes. Surrealism, mostly, yes.
Do you think it was George's love of life, whether it be art, whether it be music, whether it be food... drink, especially drink. Do you think there's something about that absolute hunger for those experiences that made him particularly attractive?
Yes, I think that's true. And also, I was brought up in a time when you didn't really say no.
When you met him in 1961, he was very much at the centre of a bohemian life in Soho. And it did mean, didn't it, when you got together, that you ended up having a sort of open marriage, both having affairs. But I think it, as so often happens, one person dealt with this more happily than the other.
And that's obviously George, isn't it? Yes. I tended to fall in love or become obsessed, and he just had a good time. Well, that's not quite true. He did have one particular woman towards the end of his... Well, not towards the end, who lasted 30 years... and she was incredibly important to him.
So is that a recipe you would advise people to follow, open marriages, or do you think on the whole it's better to hope you find somebody who you're in love with and they're in love with you?
I think that's obviously better. But I think that, I mean, because we all live so much longer now, we are expected. I mean, if you get married, let's say when you're 24 and you live to be 94, I can't quite work out how long that is, but that's a very long time. And I do know some people who have stayed married like that, not many.
Having been married to a famous jazz man for 46 years, I'm rather surprised that you haven't actually chosen any jazz. Why is that?
Well, I never really liked jazz all that much. I remember sitting through a Miles Davis concert in the south of France with George, feeling incredibly bored and sleepy. And I think of the jazz world, certainly in those days, I'm talking about the 60s, I suppose, and the 70s, as being very misogynistic. I mean, I used to go to a lot of jazz clubs with George. I mean, he couldn't drive, and I could. I drove him everywhere, partly not to let him out of my sight. And we were at a jazz club once outside Manchester, and I remember this young man coming up to us and saying to George, "Why do you always bring this bird with you? You could have any of the birds here you liked." And I remember thinking, that's, you know, I'm not only referred to as a bird, but which I'm not, or a dolly, but, you know, all those words that people used to call us by. And you don't often see women playing the drums. I mean, there were one or two blues singers. And of course, in America, there were wonderful blues singers. Here we had, I think, Ottilie Patterson. And the orchestras in the opera house, there are a lot of women there playing in classical music, a lot of women.
But you have chosen a piece for George, and it's Schubert, isn't it?
Yes.
Tell me about it. Tell me why you've chosen this.
I chose it because it's about a man who's fishing, possibly for trout, and this a beautiful water nymph says to him, "I wish you wouldn't take all my fish, like my children or whatever. Why don't you come and join me down here?" So he jumps into the water and presumably drowns, I don't know. So I feel that's about two of George's obsessions, women and fishing. He loved fishing. And so that is for him.
It's a Goethe poem, and it's sung here by the wonderful Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, with, of course, Gerald Moore playing the piano.
Das Wasser rauscht, das Wasser scholl, ein Fischer saß voran, sah nach dem Angel Ruhe voll kühl bis ans Herz hinan. Und wie er sitzt und wie er lauscht, teilt ich die Flut empor. Aus dem bewegten Wasser rauscht ein feuchtes Weib hervor. Meine Brut mit Menschenwitz und Menschenlist hinauf in Todesglut. Ach, wüsstest du, wie's Fischlein ist, so wohlig auf dem Grund. Du stiegst herunter, wie du bist, und würdest erst gesund. Das Wasser rauscht, das Wasser schwoll, wächst ihm den nackten Fuß. Sein Herz wuchs ihm so sehnsuchtsvoll wie bei der liebsten Gruß. Sie sprach zu ihm, sie sang zu ihm, da war so viel geschehen. Halt
sanke hin und ward nicht mehr gesehen.
Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau with Der Fischer, Schubert's setting of Goethe's poem, the pianist Gerald Moore, in that recording from 1964. Diana Melly, George once described your marriage as being like an elastic band that stretches but never breaks. He said it began passionately but finished with compassion, and you helped each other very much through tough times. So I'm guessing you'd probably agree with that description, and is that why the marriage lasted?
Yes, I think it is. It's also because actually George in some ways was quite a conservative person. He didn't like change. He liked change of girlfriends, but not change of wife, perhaps.
Yes.
So we did stay together. Mm. I often wonder sort of how. Mm. In fact, the next piece of music I've chosen is actually, if it's Tice, this is also for George and for me, because at the beginning of our marriage, I was the one who needed looking after. I was quite unstable, tended to be suicidal, and extremely neurotic. I mean, everyone can blame their childhood. I don't suppose my childhood was any worse than anybody else's, but my parents were divorced and I was sent away from home. And so in this duet, the couple are singing about caring for each other. So there's George caring for me at the beginning, and then at the end of our marriage, I cared for him.
When he had dementia and cancer.
Dementia and lung cancer, yeah. Yes.
And you were there with him to the end, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
Well, I think that's lovely to have, in that case, this next piece, which completes the circle, if you like, of caring and compassion and loving each other.
Yes. danse divine, voici la vera l'albine. Et si se rapportant le pas noir du couvent, elle vient vers nous, et moi je t'en priant.
René Fleming and Thomas Hampson in that duet from Act 3 of Massenet's Thaïs. Ivar Bell was conducting the Bordeaux Aquitaine National Orchestra. The unhappy story of a fourth century courtesan and actress. Well, the next opera that you've chosen is, of course, about a rake, really, isn't it, Don Giovanni? And you want to hear Dalla Sua Pace. What is it about this aria and this opera that you find so attractive?
I absolutely love Don Giovanni, but it's got to be the right Don Giovanni. But I like this particular aria when Don Ottavio, is that how you pronounce it? It's clear that Donna Anna is not interested in him. She's still mourning her father. Well, that's what she's saying anyway. Yes. But I just don't think she wants to marry him. And he's going to go on and on pleading with her. I think, and it's never going to come to anything. And I feel that I often went through, before I met George, I often went through things like that. And we've all been through things like that. I really feel for him in this. And
I think it's the yearning of unrequited love.
Exactly. And I think it's a beautiful aria as well.
Thank you.
fascinating how you've gone for voices and interpretations that stress the fragility of human beings, the vulnerability.
Yes, I think I feel quite vulnerable. I'd always have.
We heard Francesca Arezza, the tenor in that aria from the first act of Mozart's Don Giovanni, Dalla Sua Pace, with Neville Marriner conducting the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields. And of course, you can find details of all Diana Mellor's music if you go to the Private Passions website. And if you search for the programme in BBC Sounds, you can find hundreds of previous editions to download and enjoy at your leisure, which I think you have done yourself, Diana.
Yes, I have. I love listening to them. I've got my favourites.
Good. Well, we're talking a lot about loss and yearning, and you had the most awful tragic thing happened to you, which was the loss of not one but two children, didn't you?
Yes. Patrick died when he was 24 of an overdose of heroin. It was particularly tragic because he had been going to a drug rehabilitation person. He wasn't in a hospital, and he had been off heroin for 6 months, and we were thrilled. Anyway, he decided to get married to a young girl. I think he was just giving her a passport. So he got married, and George gave him some money on his wedding day. But he went back and he bought some whiskey and some heroin on his way back to collect some his things and move back into his fiancée. But, of course, he went back and took the heroin and the whiskey and died. And so that was the end of their marriage, just in a few hours.
Well, of course, if you've been free of it for several months, there isn't the ability to deal with a sudden dose,
exactly.
Is there?
Exactly, yes.
And you were involved, possibly as a result of this, in a charity that tried to help people with these problems, called Release?
Yes, but I was working for them before this happened to Patrick. I was really just the fundraiser and the person who said to the workers, who were all volunteers and paid very little, that even though they were volunteers, they should turn up on time and not after lunch. I was very unpopular.
And then, I don't want to stress this too much, but let's just hear about the second loss.
Candy. She died of breast cancer, which had spread, and they found it the day she gave birth to her second daughter.
Oh. Must have been very difficult to deal with these things, and maybe you do find some solace in music.
I certainly do. I think I always have, even if it was country and western. With Candy's death brought Patrick's back to me a lot, because Candy died after a long illness and a lot of chemo and a lot of pain, although she managed to have a lot of fun as well. She loved fun, Candy. And it brought back Patrick, Candy dying at home in her own bed, surrounded by her family, me, her husband, her mother-in-law, her two daughters. Patrick died in a squalid little room where he'd gone back to get his things with a syringe in his arm and covered in sick. So the difference between the two deaths, so Candy's death brought Patrick's back to me a great deal. So I chose this next song for them.
I get the feeling that being able to talk about these losses is in itself a kind of therapy. So is that something that you would advise people who have to deal with similar losses to do, to try and be open about talking about it? Does that help to heal the grief?
It does, but I think what's really important is that when you know that somebody is grieving about someone, you must ask them. It's no good saying, well, I don't know what to say. You can say, tell me about it. How did they die? Were you with them? Were you in hospital? You just have to ask questions. People want to talk and need to talk, but they have to be asked the right questions.
Do you think we're a bit British about this, if you know what I mean, in that if it's an awkward subject, we tend to keep quiet, when actually maybe we should be trying to communicate more by talking about it.
I'm sure that's right. I mean, I definitely talk too much about things and always have. I mean, people say I'm being brutally honest. I don't think I've been nearly honest enough.
You want to hear Kathleen Ferrier singing one of Mahler's Kindertotenlieder, his heartbreaking settings of poems by Friedrich Rückert about the death of children. The song begins, "I often think that they have just stepped out and that they will be coming home soon," words that I imagine resonate with you.
Yes. But of course, Mahler did lose. I think he'd lost a brother or a sister early on. And then he does lose a child as well. But I think he wrote this before he lost a child, didn't he? Yeah. I think.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
8 of Mahler's siblings have died in childhood.
Yes.
And these songs were sadly prescient, as 3 years after completing them, his own daughter died, aged 4, of scarlet fever. There's a wonderful bittersweet quality about that music, doesn't there?
Yes.
Sort of, it kind of flows as though, like a brook, through major and minor. And, of course, Kathleen Ferrier's voice is so idiosyncratic.
Yes.
We heard her with the 4th of Mahler's Kindertotenlieder, with the incomparable Bruno Walter conducting the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, a recording made in 1949. Diana Melli, I'm very struck that you were clearly always open to new experiences. You took up ballroom dancing at 76, wrote a book about it, done up endless houses. And since George's diagnosis, you campaigned for charities connected with dementia. You started studying philosophy. And, of course, there's this wonderful newfound love of opera. Are you somebody who always needs or looks for a project, a new passion?
Yes, I think I do. And if I get one, I'm not quite often criticised for it. Why do you always skip from one thing to the other? I don't really. Some things stay with me. I did skip from algebra to philosophy, but algebra was really, I wanted to know about relativity. And I asked my lodger, Litchevy, if he would explain relativity to me. And he said, well, you'll have to learn algebra first. This was during the pandemic when one was shut up with nothing else to do. So I did, as well as listening to opera, I learned algebra. And I could have done an O level in algebra. I'm rather pleased about that. But I didn't. I moved on to philosophy, which I'm certainly not going to do an O level in, because you never know when you've got the right answer.
Another theme that's run strongly through your life is friendships and caring for people and caring for friends. We're so bound up with romantic relationships that we tend to forget how vital strong friendships are, don't we, and new friendships as we get older.
Yes. I know the philosopher I like reading very much is called Epicurus, and he says wonderful things about friendship. I don't know what he says about music, but I'm hoping he says wonderful things about music too. But he's very, very good on friendship. And what he says about sex and love, I think, is quite interesting. He says, the best you can hope for is that it won't do you any harm.
Yes. You've loved and lost, I'm afraid, many friends from the world of literature. Jean Rhys, Bruce Chatwin.
Yes.
And most recently, the publisher, of course, Carmen Khalil. And I think you've probably had her in mind when you chose this next piece.
Absolutely. This is very much for Carmen, this one, yes. She was an enormous help to me with writing. I never gave anything to a publisher or a newspaper, or even to myself, unless I showed it to Carmen first. She couldn't believe my spelling or my punctuation, but she always liked what I wrote. She, marvellous, darling, marvellous, she would say.
So what is it you've chosen for her?
What is life for me without thee, Orphean Eurydice?
Well, we're going to hear it sung by Marilyn Horne.
Thank you.
Marin Horn was singing KFRO from Gluck's Orfeo et Euridice. George Scholte was conducting the orchestra of the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden. Diana, you say you've been lucky in life. I suppose many people might say you've been rather unlucky.
I mean, it might sound arrogant to say I've been lucky, because I think it's luck if you survive these things. And I'm not quite sure why I've survived them or why anybody survives them, but I know I have. That's luck.
But do you feel, too, that, and particularly thinking of the difficulties in your life with George, do you think that the dark informs the light, as it were? I mean, and especially when you come to some of the music you've chosen, that we deal with grief, loss and yearning in a way that can be very life-enhancing.
Yes, it is. One of the things I did, which people find quite strange, is that when George died, I went to the mortuary and helped wash his body. So I think all that kind of thing helps one deal with grief. And I never really dealt with Patrick, because on the day of his funeral, when I was meant to go and see his body, I was too drunk to go. And I've always regretted that. And I think my other main regret in life, which is probably why I like caring for people now, is I never cared for my mother. And that's a real regret for me that I can't ever put right.
As in your writing, you're brutally honest in talking about things. And I wonder how you have begun to feel, having cared for so many people you've lost, how you feel about your own mortality.
Oh, I think about it all the time. I had an operation for colon cancer 6 weeks ago now.
Gosh, you're doing well.
And so I didn't think that I would... I thought I might not survive it because of being a smoker. I've got a very bad chest, bad lungs, and I'm always getting pneumonia. Well, I've had it twice this year already. And so they said because of that, I had a... there was more of a risk. So I rather enjoyed the preparation for it. I thought, well, I don't have to bother to... I think I heard about doing Private Passions the day I was waiting in the hospital to go down for the operation. And I thought, well, this will do for my funeral as well. And I'd made all sorts of provisions for the cat and for cancelling the milk and how the cleaner would get paid. So I rather loved all the preparation for that. And then I didn't die, but it'll come in useful one day.
But you'd come to accept the fact that you might, which is helpful.
Oh, yes, yes. And I've got on my fridge is a huge notice which says I have a legal document which says do not resuscitate me. Well, I don't mind being resuscitated if I might fully recover, but I think they know what it means.
You're looking extraordinarily well, Diana, given that it is only 6 weeks since you had that operation. Your doctors must have been terribly pleased at how fit you were, even though they were worried about certain complications.
Well, the doctor did say to me, and literally had taken me there so as he would remember what was said, and the doctor said, get her exercising as much as possible. So literally took me on the back of his tandem, and we went all the way around Richmond, 7 miles I did. And at the end of it, he said, that was very good. The last woman I took said she couldn't do it again. And I said, well, nor could I. And he said, no, but you're 85, and she was only 32.
Do you think that in some ways you've perhaps come into your own as you've grown older, that in some ways old age is almost more fulfilling than youth, or is that going too far?
No, absolutely not. I read somewhere that David Bowie said, you won't know what you're really like until you're old. I'm sure it's partly because I've always been very influenced by whoever I've been with, the man I've been with. And then suddenly, now George is dead. It's just me.
For your final piece, you've chosen an aria from Verdi's Don Carlo, sung by the old king. And it's very much about old age, isn't it?
It's the father of Philip. And it's the most wonderful aria. He's sitting in his chair thinking, I'm getting old, I'm going to die, and my wife doesn't love me anymore. And I think it's absolutely beautiful.
It encompasses so many of the feelings
yes.
about old age, concern, regret. Well, that only leaves me to say I hope you stay with us for a long time, Diana. But meanwhile, thank you for sharing these feelings about music and the way that it has come to mean more and more to you as you've got older.
I think I should thank you. I've loved it.
Sua fini l'aurora in bianca e il mio verò già spunta il dì passa so
Boris Christoph singing King Philip's aria from Verdi's Don Carlo, a 1963 recording with the Philharmonia Orchestra conducted by Jerzy Semkov. And that was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on today's Private Passions, Diana Melli. The episode was produced by Jane Greenwood and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. As ever, you'll find full details of today's music if you search for Private Passions on the BBC Radio 3 website. And if you visit BBC Sounds, you'll also be able to download hundreds of previous editions of the programme. Private Passions returns next Sunday at midday when Michael's guest will be the anthropologist Hugh Brodie. This is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio, online and on BBC Sounds. Good afternoon from me, John Shea. It's 1 o'clock now and here's the latest BBC News. A passenger plane carrying 72 people has crashed in central Nepal, killing almost all those on board. At least 68 people have died in the country's worst air crash since 1992. The Yeti Airlines flight from Kathmandu went down while it was landing at a newly opened airport close to the tourist town of Pokhara. At least 15 foreign nationals were among those on the flight, including one person from the Irish Republic. Police say a 7-year-old girl is fighting for her life after a shotgun was fired from a moving car outside a church in central London yesterday. The attack happened as people left a memorial service near Euston Station for a woman from Colombia and her daughter. 5 other people were also hurt. The Labour leader, Keir Starmer, says he does not support 16-year-olds being able to change their legal gender and that he has concerns about legislation passed in Scotland last month. Scottish Labour MSPs had supported the legislation. Rescue workers in the central Ukrainian city of Dnipro are continuing to search for survivors of a Russian missile attack on a block of flats which killed at least 21 people. 40 others are still missing. The UK is calling on its allies to supply more military aid urgently to Ukraine. Rishi Sunak said Russia was on the back foot due to resupply problems and plummeting morale, offering a chance to push back Moscow's troops and secure peace. Yesterday, Britain pledged 14 Challenger tanks. The Transport Secretary says he's given rail operating companies permission to make a new offer to unions this week in a bid to end the long-running industrial dispute. Mark Harper said both parties were keen to reach an agreement that would end the strike action, but that he wouldn't put what he called an artificial timetable on an end to the negotiations. Nearly 4,000 baby seals have been spotted on a 5-mile stretch of the Norfolk coast so far this winter, a record for the region. The number, seen between Waxham and Winterton, is almost double the figure of 3 years ago. Experts say it's down to a healthy colony. And the weather, it'll be very windy with showers across Northern Ireland, central England and Wales this afternoon. There'll be some wintry showers in northern Scotland too, but elsewhere it'll be dry with some bright spells. BBC Radio 3, the news and weather at 1:02.
This week, I'm trying to unravel a mystery. Was Dmitri Shostakovich Stalin's lackey, composing to the orders of the party, or a heroic dissident, sneaking in hidden musical messages? Join me, Donald MacLeod, on a rollercoaster ride through 5 key moments of his career, from an explosive debut that made him the toast of Russia's cultural circles to the opera that led to his blacklisting by the Soviets, and a symphony which he feared, should he take a wrong step, might be his.